Before I begin, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation as the custodians of the land on which this work was developed and is presented. I offer my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Hello and welcome to the Community Library, a podcast all about stories and how and why we tell them. I'm your host, Angauri Rice. How many books have you read from the 1970s? Last year, I embarked on a challenge to read a book published in every single year of the 20th century. There's no particular reason behind this challenge, I just thought it would be something fun to do. So when I catalogued all the books from the 20th century that I'd read, I found the 1970s to be the decade from which I had read the least. If you haven't been to the community library before, welcome. My name is Angauri, I'm an actor, author, and podcaster, and I love setting reading challenges for myself. So from the 1970s, here were some of the books I'd already read. The Lives of Girls and Women by Alice Munro, 1971. The Stepford Wives by Ira Levin, 1972. Woman at Point Zero by Nazal El Sadawi, 1975. Water Under the Bridge by Sumner Locke Elliott, 1977. And Kindred by Octavia E. Butler, 1979. But I was still missing books from 1970, 1973, 1974, 1976, and 1978. So in this episode of the Community Library, I'm going to take you through my journey of reading a book published in each of those years. But how to find these books? Well, I was lucky that two of those years were already represented on my TBR. A friend had recommended me Ruby Fruit Jungle by Rita Mae Brown, published in 1973. And I'd also added Oreo by Fran Ross to my TBR after seeing some good reviews. And since the novel was reissued with a modern cover design in 2015, I had assumed it was new, but I was very surprised and pleased to find it was published in 1974. So I already had 73 and 74 covered. To find the rest of the books, I of course used the internet and consulted lists of 100 most popular books published in 1970-something. I also looked at Goodreads shelves, at New York Times bestseller lists from those years, and literary prize winners and nominees. And the last method is how I found the first book I read for this challenge. 1978, Tira Lira by the River by Jessica Anderson. I wanted to read at least one Australian book, so I consulted the list of the Miles Franklin Award winners, which is one of the most prestigious literary prizes here in Australia. The winner in 1978 was Jessica Anderson's novel Tira Lira by the River. Here's a brief synopsis. Nora Porteous, a witty, ambitious woman from Brisbane, returns to her childhood home at age 70. Her life has taken her from a failed marriage in Sydney to freedom in London, and with grace and humour, Nora recounts her life and adventures. It's a novel about the sweetness of escape and the mix of pain and acceptance that comes with returning home. I read this one first because it was simply the first to come in from the library, and it took me exactly a week to read. For a 181-page book, a week is a little long for me, but I felt the book was one that I needed to read slowly. It was quite reflective and melancholy and didn't have much plot or intrigue to keep me going. Here is the review I wrote after I finished it. Finished 25th of September 2023. Though not a particularly 70s feeling novel, since the protagonist spends most of her time musing about the past, Tira Lira by the River is definitely awash with nostalgia. I found it to be a sad story about a creative woman who could have been an artist but was never given the time, space, or opportunity. While Nora looked back on her life and saw it with a new perspective, I was left with a sense of melancholy. It makes me glad to know that the author died at the age of 93, having written 7 novels and won the Miles Franklin Award twice. If the book should have taught me anything, it's that material success does not make the woman, but in the end, it does make me happier for her. 6 months later, I don't remember much about this book. I sort of remember it in fragments and pieces, I guess much like the character of Nora remembers and recounts her own life. But I thought it was a very insightful look at a woman's life, especially in Australia and England in the early to mid 20th century. It's not a glamorous book, but I really liked that about it. 1974, Oreo by Fran Ross. Next up was a book I could not find at the library, so I bought it secondhand from World of Books, and that's Oreo by Fran Ross, published in 1974. I didn't know what to expect going into this book. I had forgotten what the review that I read had said about it, and I had just like added it to my cart, trusting that if I had been interested in it at some point, then I would for sure be interested in it again. So here is a brief synopsis. Oreo is raised by her maternal grandparents in Philadelphia. Her black mother tours with a theatrical troupe, and her Jewish deadbeat dad disappeared when she was an infant, leaving behind a mysterious note that triggers her quest to Manhattan to find him. What ensues is a playful, modernized parody of the classical Odyssey of Theseus with a feminist twist. Coming in at 212 pages, this novel took me 9 days to read. Again, a little longer than usual. I read it directly after Tirralira by the River, and it was very interesting to compare these two novels, which, apart from both being written in the 1970s, were very, very different. Here is the review I wrote after finishing it. Finished 5th of October, 2023. It's not hard to understand why this completely wacky book only found acclaim 50 years after its first publication. It's experimental, darkly funny, and at times very confronting. It took a while to get going, and I much preferred the second half of the novel, in which Oreo embarks on her mission to find her father in New York City. Her trials and tribulations are loosely based on the myth of Theseus, and I most enjoyed the chapters in which I remembered the original myth and could see the clever comparisons. This book feels bizarrely modern, though there are hints to its 70s origins, some terms we no longer use today, and scenes which nowadays would need a trigger warning. I'm pleased that this modern myth has found its place in the literary canon, albeit 50 years after the fact, and sadly, 40 years after the death of its author. I'm not sure if you can tell from my review, but this book contains some quite shocking content. The blurb describes this book as playful, but I think I described it as confronting and wacky. It's not something I would recommend widely, but it was fascinating to read. It's a novel that I've continued to think about, not necessarily for a particular storyline or character, but more so for what it achieved as a text and how it now sits in the literary canon. 1973, Ruby Fruit Jungle by Rita Mae Brown. Next, I read the book that had actually been recommended to me by a friend, Ruby Fruit Jungle by Rita Mae Brown, published 1973. I really trusted this friend's recommendation, so I didn't even research any other books published in 1973 that I might be interested in. Again, I bought a copy from World of Books since it was unavailable at my library. Here's a brief synopsis. Ruby Fruit Jungle tells the story of Molly Bolt, the adoptive daughter of a dirt-poor southern couple who boldly forges her own path in America. With her startling beauty and crackling wit, Molly finds that women are drawn to her wherever she goes, and she refuses to apologize for loving them back. A lesbian coming-of-age novel about being true to yourself and, against the odds, living happily ever after. So I read this book immediately after Oreo, and this time it was not difficult to see the similarities between the two. Published just a year apart, they're both about young women moving to New York to seek fortune, freedom, happiness. Here's my review. Finished 12th of October, 2023. I wish I was able to read this novel through the eyes of someone reading it in the 1970s. I imagine it would have been a very different experience. What now seems like a classic queer coming-of-age story about a young woman running away to New York City, in the 1970s it was groundbreaking. Molly is never unsure about who she is. She never lies about her sexuality, never falters in her opinions, never gives up on her dreams. What feels remarkable about it is that Molly seems to know she is born in the wrong time. She expects she might have to wait 30 years for the world to change enough to allow her to get what she wants. I love the last line of the book, a hopeful call into the future. quote, "If it does take that long, then watch out, world, because I'm going to be the hottest 50-year-old this side of the Mississippi," end quote. Ruby Fruit Jungle was definitely less provocative and experimental than Oreo, and it was simply quite a sweet coming-of-age novel, which I can imagine was quite radical at the time. At 246 pages, I read it in a week, and I think of the three I had read for the challenge so far, this one was the fastest because it was the most readable. It was fast-paced, grounded in reality, and I was very happy to report back to the friend who recommended it that it had been a success. 1976, Woman on the Edge of Time by Marge Piercy. I struggled to find something to read for 1976. When I started researching what to read from this year, I immediately wrote down Interview with the Vampire by Anne Rice. Even though I hadn't seen the movie, I love vampires, so I thought this would for sure be a hit. So I picked it up from the library, started reading it, but unfortunately I found the writing just really dense and difficult to read. I struggled to keep reading, so I gave up about halfway through and read the rest of the plot on Wikipedia to satisfy my curiosity. I'm sorry. And then I was back to square one. So I was interested in three books from 1976, but one I couldn't find anywhere. One was only available as an ebook, and I didn't want to read on my iPad. So by process of elimination, I decided to read Woman on the Edge of Time by Marge Piercy, which was available from the library. Here's a brief synopsis. Connie Ramos, a woman in her mid-30s, has been declared insane. But Connie is overwhelmingly sane, merely tuned to the future and able to communicate with the year 2137. As her doctors persuade her to agree to an operation, Connie struggles to force herself to listen to the future and its lessons for today. This was the longest book I read for the challenge, coming in at 417 pages, and it also took me a week to read. To be honest, I almost gave up on this one too. It was quite an unrelenting and unforgiving portrayal of the mental health care system in the 1970s, and it was really difficult to read about the constant trauma and violence being inflicted upon the main character and the supporting characters in the book. So I had to take frequent breaks from reading. I even considered not finishing the book, but eventually I found out I just couldn't give up on Connie and I needed to see her story through to the end. So here's my review. Finished 26th of January, 2024. Woman on the Edge of Time is a fascinating look at what a politically active author in the 1970s wanted the future to look like. When Consuelo is wrongfully put into Bellevue Psychiatric Hospital by her niece's pimp, she finds her escape in connecting with Luciente, a time traveler from 2137. With Luciente's help, Consuelo is able to visit the utopian Mataposet, a community without prejudice and power, where gender and sexuality is fluid and racism has been eradicated. Everything is owned by the community and all single-use items are compostable. Though the length and writing style didn't always gel with me, I found this novel to be so thought-provoking. We're now 50 years closer to 2137 than when the book was written, and though I also want a future like the utopia Piercy illustrates, I don't think we're any closer to it. Perhaps we're even further away. In her introduction to the 2019 edition, Piercy states that her intention was not to predict the future. Quote, "The point of creating futures is to get people to imagine what they want and don't want to happen down the road, and maybe do something about it," end quote. I ultimately found this novel to be really fascinating and thought-provoking. I just wish it had been told in 300 pages instead of 400. The ideas did stick with me though, even though the story was quite long and dense. I've continued to think about Marge Piercy's version of 2137. 1970, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, by Judy Blume. So finally, the last book I had to read was from the start of the decade, 1970. There were multiple strong contenders for this year. The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison was one. Abigail by Magda Jabo was another, perhaps lesser known in the English-speaking world, but I had read another novel from this Hungarian author and loved it. But ultimately, After the tragedy of Woman on the Edge of Time, I wanted something nice and fun. So I picked up Judy Blume's classic, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Here's a brief synopsis. Margaret Simon, almost 12, has just moved from New York City to a suburb in New Jersey and is anxious to fit in with her new friends. When they form a secret club to talk about private subjects like boys, bras, and getting their first periods, Margaret is happy to belong. But none of them can believe Margaret doesn't have a religion and that she isn't going to the Y or the Jewish Community Center. Soon, Margaret realizes it's time for her to decide who she wants to be. I had already watched the film adaptation in late 2023, so that influenced my decision to read this book. And it felt like a bit of a cheat because I already knew the story, but I just didn't want to go through the trial and error that I did with 1976. This book was only 152 pages and I read it in 3 days. Here's my review. Finished 12th of March, 2024. How impressive that such a subtle and slight middle grade novel became one of the most well-loved and recognizable titles in the West. Until I watched the 2023 film adaptation, I thought the story was going to be all about a girl getting her period for the first time, as cultural reputation and pre-adolescent gossip led me to believe. However, I found it to be a relatable and moving coming-of-age story, mostly about a young girl feeling like she has to choose between the two religions her parents were born into, Judaism or Christianity. I understand why it was so revolutionary at the time, because it didn't shy away from the realities of adolescence. What disappoints me is that still, in 2024, characters in novels rarely get their periods, whether for the first time or the 100th time. What was radical for Judy Blume to write about is still somewhat radical today. Looking back on this book now, it's really hard to find something unlikable about it. It's so sweet and tender and was obviously very important for young readers in the 1970s, but I imagine it would still be important for young readers today. And even though I'm not in the age demographic for this book, I really enjoyed it and it was a nice way to end my 1970s reading challenge. After finishing these 5 books, I was thinking about what they have in common. So obviously they're all by women and about women, but that's not a surprise because most of the books I read are by women and about women. It's a little surprising, I guess, that 4 of the 5 books are set wholly or partially in New York City. This was pure coincidence. But there are also some deeper connections between the books. Most of them discuss politics, gender, race, class, and religion. Most of them could be considered radical for their time. Even in the case of Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, though the text might not appear that radical in comparison with something like Ruby Fruit Jungle or Oreo, it was on the list of the American Library Association's 100 most frequently challenged books from its publication well into the 2000s. And so I wonder to what degree these books reflect the 70s literary scene and to what degree they simply reflect my taste in reading. Obviously, the similarities between them are going to reflect what I look for in a book, but I also think they reflect something of the 1970s. That decade was famously a time of change. People were protesting, calling for equality, societal change, and peace. It was a time of radical thought and action, and I can see that reflected in these books. Even Tiralira by the River, which stands out because it's not American and it doesn't take place in New York City like the rest of them, it's radical in how it represents the harsh reality of how our world treats women, much like Woman on the Edge of Time does, showing how Connie is treated in the psychiatric ward. Another thing these books have in common is that they're looking towards the future. Ruby Fruit Jungle ends on that hopeful line about waiting 30 years for the world to be different. Oreo and Margaret are just at the beginning of their journeys. They're discovering more about themselves before they transition into adulthood or teenagehood. And Connie and Nora are older characters looking back on their lives. In Connie's case, she has a literal connection with the future, which is the only thing that gives her hope, while Nora's story is about her coming to understand her past so she can accept her future. So if I were to boil it down, let's say, I think the books have these 2 things in common, a desire for freedom, and a hope for the future. Sometimes when you read books published in the first half of the 20th century, I find it hard to find the author's opinions or attitudes about the politics and societal structures of the time. When I think about a book such as The Great Gatsby, which is quite critical of wealth and social hierarchy in the 1920s, it's done in a particularly coded way. Reviewers at the time said the plot was quote-unquote unrealistic, when Fitzgerald had never intended it to be realistic. He wrote a heightened version of reality, rife with symbolic messaging, in order to reveal deep truths about society. But a lot of people seem to miss the point. Similarly, when I think about queer characters in classics, often their queerness is never named or addressed, but alluded to with particular coded phrases. So what's amazing about this collection of books from the 1970s is that they're not mincing words. You don't have to read between the lines to understand the author is critical of gender norms or that a character is queer. And because I can see these opinions and criticisms so clearly on the page, it really illustrates what the author wants for the future of their characters and for the future of the world. And when I was thinking about this, I found it very sobering to read these books 50 years after they were written and see how we measure up. And even if I don't want a utopia exactly like the one that Marge Piercy wrote in her book, there are so many elements in there that are so beautiful and wonderful, and I feel that we're so far away from them. I do imagine that the world has changed enough to give Molly Bolt and Oreo freedom and safety in their identities, but only conditionally and only in particular places, and always with the threat of that freedom and safety being revoked. It's amazing to see the fearlessness and strength of these authors writing such political and radical works, but it's disappointing to think about how we're still fighting the same battles 50 years later. A devastating example that comes to mind for me is the overturning of Roe v. Wade 49 years after the landmark decision was made in 1973. I don't want to sort of say that reading these books made me feel apathetic and despondent. I mean, they did in some ways, but overall, I feel two really positive things. I feel gratitude and responsibility. I'm really grateful that these books exist and thankful for what they did in paving the way for books to come. And I feel a responsibility to make the world a better and safer place than it was for these writers and their characters 50 years ago. I've read a lot of books published outside of my lifetime, and I always learn so much, but maybe I had this idea in my head that books from the latter half of the 20th century were too recent for me to learn much from them, and this experiment definitely proved me wrong. I've now read 85 books out of the 100 I need to read for this challenge, and this 1970 section did not at all diminish my desire to complete it. So I'm still missing 15 years, and I'm thinking of going backwards through the decades. So the next 3 years I'm missing are 1959, 1941, and 1930. I'm thinking of reading Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry, Blithe Spirit by Noel Coward, and Vile Bodies by Evelyn Waugh, respectively. If you have any other ideas for what I should read for those years, let me know. As always, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I had a lot of fun making it, and I will chat to you soon. Bye.